Oh boy.
It's going to be a long one. Jinx, buy me a Coke.
Fine. I'll buy you a Coke if you can actually guess what I'm drinking.
You're supposed to, actually, you can't talk until you buy me a Coke. That's how Jinx works, just so you know.
Oh, no.
It's not eggnog season already, is it?
No, but you're very close. Like, there's only two drinks that occupy this particular category of alcoholic beverage.
Very close to eggnog, and it's alcoholic. I'll say, is it a Brandy Alexander?
No.
Oh, okay. Don't scoff at me like that. Is it a $5 shake with bourbon in it?
Oh, no. That would be great, though. If I could have one of those right now, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. No, it's Irish cream.
Just straight Irish cream?
Well, on the rocks.
Okay. It is, yeah, 'tis the season, I suppose.
'Tis the season. Yeah, we set up our Christmas decorations today. And while were out, yeah, buying some. Yeah, it's a little early, I know, but I don't know. Kind of wanted to get it out of the way.
Well, yeah, winter came all at once to Edmonton.
Yeah, exactly. Weekend, it snowed and it was crazy and it's cold out. And we just decided that we wanted to set up the winter decorations.
Right. The winter decorations. And that. And one of the decorations is a 2-6 of Bailey's. Is that what you're saying?
I picture you plopping
down at your office desk and just like slamming the 2-6 of Bailey's on, saying, "Christmas is here.
It's here. Yeah.
The decorations are set." And yeah.
It's sort of like, I don't know. I think we normally decorate the tree and decorate the house like a little closer to Christmas, like in December. And it's kind of usually on that day, I guess, where I start to feel like, you know, I want to do Christmassy things and have Christmassy drinks and eat Christmassy snacks.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So when we were setting up our decorations and putting the decorations on our tree today and stuff, we had to run out and grab a couple things for like setting things up. And while we were out, I was like, it'd be really nice while you're decorating the tree if we had some Baileys. So
yep, I do the same thing. Well, not Baileys, but if we're trimming the tree, Shale, then I definitely am making either hot toddies or mulled wine or something like that.
Yeah,
I would never do it in November, of course, because that's just
insanity.
Unless the first Sunday of Advent happens to fall at the end of November, but.
Right. Oh, is that what it is? The first Sunday of Advent?
I don't know. If, you know, Shell, when you're in a relationship, you always have to make compromises. And for me, I would say like the Christmas tree should not go up. It should only go up the first Sunday of Advent. That's what I would say.
Okay.
Not before. You can do it after. That's fine, but.
Do you need a Catholic calendar to tell you what day that is? Or I
think it's just the fourth Sunday before Christmas.
Before Christmas.
It's easier than Easter. Like Easter is like the first Sunday after the first full moon or after the vernal equinox or something like that. But
sorry, I'll never understand that.
Anyways, I think we do the first weekend in December.
Yeah.
This year, December 1st is on a Sunday, so I think we're technically doing the second weekend of December, but it doesn't matter. Hmm. Winter came. Man, we got so much snow, and we did maple taffy in the snow with the kids.
Oh, fun.
And yeah, it was good.
How'd it turn out?
Good. It was like it's a pretty delicate operation, Shale. You got to like nail that sugar temperature. And yeah. I was really close to where I wanted it to be, but everybody was getting really restless and they had been like kind of called assembled a little bit too early. And so there was three kids who really wanted to eat maple syrup.
Man, everyone always underestimates how long it takes to get sugar to the right temperature.
Yeah.
It's a delicate process.
I was using too small a pot. So it was like prone to boiling over. And so I had it at an especially low temperature to just like bubble away. And so, yeah, it probably took 30 minutes.
That's tricky with maple syrup. It has a tendency to want to boil over. And yeah, usually if you need to do anything with it quickly, you have to put it in a gigantic pot.
Right. Yeah. But it was good, but it was like on the soft side, but not like, it was still like easy to pick up with the, we didn't have popsicle sticks. So we just like snipped twigs off of one of our dogwood trees or something.
That's cool. Could have used a chopstick maybe.
Yeah, that's true actually. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it would have just slipped around because they're too round or something, but
I like my rustic.
Your twig idea. Twig. Yeah. I like your twig idea too.
So it's a little bit on the soft side, but still like not runny or anything. Like you could still pick it up. And there's actually having the little bit of snow in it when you eat it so awesome.
Yeah. It needs to be there. It's a part of the treat for sure.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it's like you have like, I mean, it cools really quickly, but you have like molten maple syrup and little icy snow pieces on it. Like it's really fun to eat.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, a few years ago, the last time I actually had that was a few years ago. I went to like a winter festival in Calgary and they had a little sugar shack there and got to make some.
So I think we might have talked about this before, but every spring, McKernan Elementary has basically a food truck. Well, it's not a truck, but it's like a
trailer.
Trailer, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. A sugar shack trailer that comes and serves the kids maple taffy.
Oh, cool.
It's usually aligned with, there's like a Francophonie kind of week, and they have that set up. And I'm curious.
Do they have
to know,
people
like,
come and tell stories too, like Christmas stories?
Not for
and
this.
Things?
This is just like, I think I'll give you their business card, Shil. They're just there to. The trailer is like outfitted with the kind of like voyageur kind of things you would expect. Like there's like beaver pelts and snowshoe, like old like tennis racket style snowshoes and stuff like that hung on it. I always wonder when I see it, like, can you, when I think about it as a food service operation, can they like reduce the maple syrup to the right temperature and then just like pour it in a Cambro and chill it? And then when they get on site, they just warm it up. And as soon as it's hot enough to be liquid, they can just pour it on snow.
I'm sure that partially must be what they're doing. Like, surely they're not reducing it all the way when they roll up in their truck.
Right.
I think it can be a little bit tricky to reheat a lot of, like, sugar that's solidified. And maple sugar especially has a tendency to crystallize. So there's probably only a certain, you know, like, you can probably only reduce it so far without running into the possibility that it might crystallize. I don't know. I wonder. I'm curious to see, to find out like what they do to speed up that process on site. Cause I mean, like
the one, like the batch that we made yesterday, what was left over in the pot, I just left it in the pot and then went to bed. I turned the stove off, but then I left it in the pot and went to bed.
Good thinking.
And so I'm going to try and reheat it and see if it will make good taffy.
Did it stay clear?
No.
Oh, it's crystallized?
Like it's interesting. Like it's a hard, opaque, maple colored brown.
Okay. Brown. Yeah. Right. I think, I don't know. I don't know. I wonder. I'm not sure. I have never tried to do that, like crystallized maple syrup, like remelting crystallized maple sugar. I've only ever gone the other direction. So I don't know. You might have to like add a fair amount of water to it to get it to reliquify and then reduce it again. But, let me know how it goes. Curious.
Kate?
I was in French immersion and we had all kinds of festival d'hiver kind of activities in the winter. Right. And we would usually make maple taffy, and somebody would come and like tell like campfire stories and stuff. Right. And some of the stories I still sort of remember, and they were, some of them were
pretty dark.
Kind of dark, yeah.
That's what,
a little freaky.
Yeah, like Chasse Galerie and stuff, like the flying canoe and...
Oh, yeah.
Is that one? Like, that's the one that they tell...
Yeah, and Loup-Garou is like the sort of like the wolf in the woods or something. I don't know.
It's right.
Like, sort of like a werewolf story.
Yeah. Like, so have you been to the Flying Canoe Festival? Surely you have.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they have the like costumed storytellers just like roaming through Mill Creek Ravine.
Oh, cool.
And they have the wolves. Like they're like wolves, like people dressed as wolves with like glowing red eyes, and they're howling and they're chasing Jean-Baptiste and stuff. And
I've never seen that when I've been down there. Yeah. But that, yeah. That sounds amazing. I'm gonna have to go back this year and keep my eyes peeled. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sudeby. How are you, Alan?
Kind of tired, but I'm otherwise good. Thank you.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. And now we're never allowed to talk about it ever again. Alan, are you sad?
No, I'm not sad, Shale.
Oh, good.
But... it is like a, it's a transition. It's a, I'm feeling nostalgic, and like it's the idea of it ending for now, has given me pause. And I think I didn't really, for me, the last few years, like it's kind of been, we kind of do, you put a lot of time into it. For me, it's kind of like a seat of the pants kind of thing, where like I think about it very little, but then we make time and we sit down for a few hours and talk and record. And then you do all the really hard stuff, like editing it and posting it and everything.
But it's still really a seat of the pants thing for me too.
Yeah. And so it's, in a way, it's like... saying that this is going to be the last recording of this sort has, like, I've had, it's prompted me to think about the last few years and what we've talked about and what effect it's had on me. And we've done a little bit of that kind of reflection before on, I can't remember, like on pod, what do we call it? Podiversaries?
Yeah, that's right.
And maybe New Year's Day kind of like... reflection and resolution type things. But yeah, this change has allowed me to think about it a little bit more purposefully, and I don't feel sad. Like we are stopping for a reason, and so I'm not sad. And I'm kind of grateful for this opportunity to reflect on what we've done over the last few years.
Yeah, that's good. I think nostalgia is the perfect mood to be in for this episode because, I think, you know, the idea is to look back at what it's been like to be on the podcast and talk about some of the highlights and things like that. So that's perfect. Nostalgia is great. I'm not sad either, Alan. I'm pretty confident that, you know, we will resurrect this show in another format at some point in the not too distant future. And I do like, if there weren't good reasons for kind of putting it on hiatus for now, right now, then, you know, I mean, we wouldn't be doing it. And so, right. Those reasons, you know, make me feel like it's a good idea. And some of those reasons are to give me some time to work on some other projects that I have kicking around in my head and stuff like that. And I'm excited to work on those. So, I don't feel sad. I do feel nostalgic, and like you said, it's a change thing. It's also pretty crazy. This is episode 100 of the show. I don't know. Like, I didn't necessarily not think that we would get to episode 100, but I don't think when we started the show that we would be making episode 100 ever. So it's kind of cool. Anyway, before we get into all that, Alan,
yeah,
do we have follow-up?
Yeah, we've got one big chunk of follow-up.
Mm-hmm. It's a good chunk.
About a week ago, there was an article published in the New York Times. And I think I don't have it in front of me, but I think the title was The 25 Most Influential Cookbooks of the Last 100 Years. And like usually lists, like list articles like that are just kind of clickbaity things. And this was not that. It was actually a long and thoughtful, intelligent article.
It has several really good contributors.
Yeah, and it, like a really thoughtful kind of survey of cookbooks, like from the American perspective, like cookbooks that influenced Americans. Mm-hmm. And I was like, obviously, it touched on lots of books and chefs and authors that we've mentioned on the show. But yeah, I wanted to talk about it briefly because it was, all things considered, like it was a great little piece. Like I was,
yeah.
Yeah. So we want to talk about that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. I think like my overall impression is that like there are several books on this list that I've heard of but I've never actually looked through a copy. And then there are a few books on this list that I've never heard of.
Yes.
Actually, like a fair few, like at least a dozen.
I'd say half of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And and there's just like a kind of a short blurb about each one and, you know, why it's on the list and kind of sort of like who put it forward or whatever.
Right.
And yeah, every one of the paragraphs about the books made me want to, for the ones that I wasn't familiar with, maybe want to be able to get a copy and look through it and read through it.
Yeah. One of the things that was so enjoyable about reading the article was there was obviously a few that like I own and I'm very familiar with. And there was a few that I had heard of, but haven't read. And yeah, lots that I had never heard of. And it like made me, you know, write my reading list for next summer, right, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I think
can find copies, I guess, of some of these.
Right. Yeah. I think it was, you know, for like the title, like 25 Most Influential Cookbooks of the Last 100 Years. It was definitely skewed towards a certain era. Like I would say,
at least to the last 50 years and skewed even more, I think, to the last 25, but.
Well, no, actually I was going to say earlier than that. Like it was kind of like, to me, it was kind of like mid-century America skewed. Like it was Julia
but
Child.
There's barely anything on it that is 100 years old. Like there's there's one thing that's on it that's like almost 100 years old. There's maybe three things that are like in the like 70 to 80 years old kind of thing. But everything else is like, you know, probably not more than 50.
I didn't actually look. I think the oldest book they have there is How to Cook a Wolf by MFK Fisher, which came out during the Second World War. I don't think there was anything older than that.
There is something older than that, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, there's something. Yeah, no, maybe you're right. But The Joy of Cooking
is 50s, I think, right?
No, it's earlier. Or like 1931, The Joy of Cooking.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it says like right next to the title of the book in the article. Mm-hmm. Originally published in 1931. But yeah, I think like, you know, it really became popular, like you said, like in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And there are several editions. So the first edition was published in 1931. But man, that's a long time.
Yep. Almost 100 years. Yeah. So there was some of the, like, certainly ones that you would expect to see on the list, like Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which I always say is by Julia Child, but then this article reminded me that it's actually by three women.
Three authors, yeah.
Yeah, Simone Beck, Louisiette Berthold, and Julia Child.
Nobody's ever heard of those other ladies, though, Alan. Did any of them have a TV show? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Probably.
There's a great photo of one of them writing. I love that they put MFK Fisher on it, and they basically, it's interesting because they say, not. I think the book of hers they put on is How to Cook a Wolf, but they say that her earlier book, Serve It Forth, like, in quote, right, invented American food writing.
Which, yeah, that's is crazy.
True. And it's like, that's like, there wouldn't be Jeffrey Steingarten or maybe not even Jonathan Gold without MFK Fisher. The Art of Fermentation by Sandor Katz, Nose to Tail Eating by Fergus Henderson, The French Laundry, yeah, Cookbook by Thomas Keller, and the other one that we've actually mentioned it a couple of times, not in detail, but The Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking by Marcella, right, Hazan was on there too.
I actually, so like, I'm not super familiar with that book. You may have mentioned it, but like, I've seen it, I'm aware of it, but I've never really been in contact with it or leafed through it or anything.
It might, I don't know, like, if it were published today, it might not, oh, sorry, if it were published today, it wouldn't be groundbreaking, but I think, right, for coming out, I think it was published in the early 90s. And for me, it was one of just a handful of books that really introduced me to, well, sorry, this is a dumb thing to say, but the essentials of Italian cooking, but also like the regionality, like the,
I'm not laughing because it was a dumb thing to say, Alan. I'm laughing because it's funny and you think it's dumb. I think that's funny.
But I mean, like, for North Americans, changing, or sorry, broadening their understanding of Italian cooking from like spaghetti and red sauce to you know, think, like, it was the first time I had read
regional
about polenta
dishes and
polenta
old
and risotto
food traditions
and, like,
and
so there was like this cluster of books where I was like, yes, of course that's on this list, like, mm-hmm, awesome, yeah, they get it. And there was some, it was interesting, like, a good chunk of the list is like someone who usually either an American or a British author who have found a way to like introduce a cuisine to North Americans. Yeah. They're like the translator of the cuisine. And so there was lots of great examples of that. Some
of
which
Cuisines
of
Mexico by Diana Kennedy,
which is
a book that I'm not really aware of. And when I saw it, I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. Like, it's published in 1972.
Yeah.
And it looks like it has a lot of like really authentic Mexican cuisine in it. And then they talk about how great the book is. And then some of the contributors talk about, like, you know, what that means, you know, like culturally to have a white woman writing this book, you know, about Mexican cuisine, but like she lived in Mexico. And
do say,
and,
say it's,
and some
sorry,
of the contributors say that like a lot of Mexicans use the book as a reference. Like,
right. So, sorry, yeah, do they mean that it's problematic? That
they mean
American,
like,
or?
It could be perceived as being problematic, but seemingly in the context of the research for this book, it's like really well researched and really well representative of the actual cuisines, and so it's kind of hard to like point a finger at it and say that it's problematic, you know?
Right. The other really good example on the list, Fuchsia Dunlop. I think the one book of hers that they pick is called Land of Plenty, but she has several. I think there's one, I can't remember, it has a fairly broad title, like The Cooking of Sichuan Province or something. And she has one called Land of Fish and Rice. She's from the UK, and she was the first, non-Chinese person
to read the little blurb from the,
sure. Yeah.
In 1994, after 2 years of studying Mandarin, the English writer Fuchsia Dunlop became the first foreigner to enroll in the Sichuan Institute of Higher Cuisine.
Okay, that's what I was trying to say. but it was funny because this is one of those things where once you're made aware of something or someone, you realize that it's kind of popping up all over the place. And so in 1 week, I went from having never heard of Fuchsia Dunlop to having her come up 3 times. I was at a friend's house, a couple who met and lived in Shanghai for years, and they had this gorgeous book displayed in their kitchen called Land of Fish and Rice. And I picked it up and was leafing through it. And they're like, oh, yeah, Fuchsia Dunlop is great. Here, you check out this Sichuan too. Like, they pulled that one off of the shelf. And then I read this New York Times article that mentioned her. And then I was randomly in the library at Nate looking for I don't know what. And then like, those books were in the library already. So that's like the top of my reading list for next summer, is to look at her, her work on Chinese cooking.
Alan, you're obsessed with Sichuan.
Kind of. Well, I mean, obsessed, like I don't know anything about it, but I like eating
but
it and I want to know more.
About it. Yeah. Alan, just a quick aside, just before we got on the recording tonight, I was watching a YouTube video by, Chinese Cooking Demystified.
Okay.
And it's like a description of 63 regional cuisines in China.
Okay.
This video that just came out. It's crazy. Yeah. It's pretty interesting.
This is one of the biggest changes in general understanding over my lifetime. Like, to go from like the way that we talked about lots of places, but especially about China when I was a kid, it was like China. Yeah. It's China.
It's
they speak Chinese. And then like, it's mostly just like me growing and learning and everything. But, and then, you know, in my mid-20s, it was like, oh yeah, Italian food, there's a regionality to it. There are provinces and they have different traditions. But it's like that sensibility or that understanding is kind of broadening now where it's like,
and there's just China so much information out there about all of it, you know, like,
yeah. And it's daunting and intimidating, but like, it's one of the most exciting things for me right now. Like for me personally, like whether it's eating in restaurants in Edmonton or cooking, like trying to understand even a little bit of what is going on there.
Another quick aside, I'm planning a trip to Hokkaido, which is like a different regional Japanese area that I haven't been to, and I'm really excited to go there and try the food in Hokkaido.
Well, that's cool. When's that gonna happen?
I'm not exactly sure yet, but they have a bunch of winter festivals in February, and that's what I want. I want to try. Want to try and hit some of the winter festivals because it's in northern Japan, so it gets really cold and it gets really snowy, and they have like these big winter festivals, and they build like ice sculptures and snow sculptures. And
I cannot hear the word Hokkaido without thinking of the Simpsons joke of Homer going to the public library and asking for a phone book for Hokkaido, Japan, and then the librarian saying, here you go, sir. First of all, the librarian picking it up instantly and just slapping it down on the counter in front of him as if it was like within arm's reach. And then Homer says, and can I use your telephone? And the librarian says, sure, is it a local call? And Homer says, yes.
Yeah.
And then he
dial like
and then
30
he,
numbers.
Exactly. Like really like holding down the keys like obnoxiously long. So it's like beep, 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 beep. And it goes on and on. Anyways.
That's amazing.
So you mean February of 2025, you might go to Japan again.
Soon.
Wow. You're obsessed.
Mere months from now. Yeah, I am obsessed.
Yeah.
Let's move on before we fall down a rabbit hole.
Right. Okay. Was there when you read this list, was there anything or any glaring omissions that you were affronted to not see?
I mean, it's so subjective, you know, like I don't know enough. I don't know enough about cookbooks to really know what should be on this list. And anything that I hold dear as a cookbook is just something that at some point I got interested in and, you know, really found valuable for me. But that doesn't usually say anything about like its value to, you know, influencing
the continent.
Yeah, yeah. Influencing the culture of the United States. So, you know, I can't really comment on whether I think the list is well made or not. I have to trust that they put a lot of thought into it. Yeah, like you said, quite a few things that I saw on the list made me feel like they'd really thought about it. Like the fact that the French Laundry cookbook is on the list, you know, like it doesn't really do much for home cooks, you know? And so I think it's sort of like could be an easy omission, but it does like they don't even really say this when they're talking about it, but like, well, they kind of do, I guess. But like, you know, it influenced so many chefs who were doing modern food in the United States that it just like has this like crazy lasting knock-on effects of influencing like every restaurant chef in the 90s, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Or every
2000s.
Sort of,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess 2000s, yeah. And like maybe mostly in the fine dining arena, but not even like it has like really far reaching in terms of technique and flavor combinations and popularizing foods that people hadn't heard of and all of that. Like, you know, there's just a lot that flows from that book. And if that hadn't been on it, I feel like I would have to say that that's a glaring omission.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I don't think that the food lab could be on that list, but maybe in 20 years, food lab could be on that list or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just a very comprehensive, very smartly written, and very like, and like a book that works, you know?
Yeah.
Like when you go to make recipes from it. Really works. In terms of popularity, it's nothing close to probably any of the books that are on the list, but and this also probably could never be on the list, but On Food and Cooking is also extremely influential. And like,
yeah, but it's not a cookbook though. I think that's
true.
I think you're right.
It's like a reference, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no question that it's one of the most influential food books. But yeah, I think they worded everything very carefully, and it's cookbooks. And so, you know, there's no recipes really in On Food and Cooking. And so it's not
really that's true. Yeah. What about you? For any glaring omissions?
Not really. I think it's a really thoughtful and well-written piece. I would have, in terms of that, introducing Americans to foreign cuisines, like in a respectful and thoughtful way, there was a couple that I would have expected to be on there, a couple authors. Paula Wolfert wrote a book I think in the 70s called Couscous and Other Good Food from Morocco that's been published many like in several editions since then, and Elizabeth David, who's not like Julia Child because she didn't have a TV show and stuff, but wrote a lot about French and Italian regional cooking in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And like her books are like, they're considered so important that they've been published as like part of the Penguin Classics series. And so I would have thought maybe she'd be on there, but it's not a glaring omission. It's like they have another author who wrote about like food from the Middle East and North Africa. So,
yeah, I think they probably kind of had to go through, you know, all of the cuisines from other parts of the world and sort of like pick one author and one book to represent each, you know, like, because all of those influences now are prevalent in the United States.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to pick a voice for each of them.
Right.
If you don't want to, you know, like omit something that has been influential. And then I guess you have to kind of like look through that catalog and okay, well, like what's the like pinnacle of that catalog, or what's the first book to really break ground in that particular regional cuisine or whatever, and that's what's going to make the list. So yeah, and I don't have enough knowledge to know so.
And the only other thing, again, like, I don't think it's a glaring omission, but you kind of have the Rollman influence because of his participation in the French Laundry cookbook. I do think that Charcuterie by Rollman and Poulsen is, to me, it's one of them. And again, like, I have a skewed perspective, but that would have been one of the biggest ones of the last 30 years anyways.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. Like, but I just think, you know, probably in terms of its reach in the culture, it's just like,
exactly.
Maybe not quite on par with a lot of those other books. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, it's a really cool article. It's not behind the New York Times paywall, which is refreshing.
Shocking.
And I'll post a link to it in our show notes, so anyone that's interested in it can check it out. There is a Japanese cookbook on there from the 80s?
Yeah. The Simple Art of Japanese Cooking or something like that.
Yeah. I'm really interested in trying to find a copy of that book. I wonder if there's one in the library. Japanese Cooking, A Simple Art by Shizuo Tsuji. Introduction by M.F.K. Fisher.
Hey!
Yeah, really want to find a copy of this book. So I guess I'm going to check the library.
If it's not at the public library, I can almost guarantee it's in this in the repository of the university library.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They used to have like a cookbook section in Rutherford, and a lot of that got shunted into the repository. So you have to like
request it
and go pick it up from somewhere on like the Sherwood Park Freeway or something. I don't know where it is, but
yeah. And I'll have to bribe a student to do it for me probably. So I'm going to offer somebody some beer or something. I don't know how that works.
You don't have to bootleg for university students, Shale.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. What is it that then I have nothing to offer them? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
This is an impossible problem. So, episode 100, end of season one of Food Court.
That's a nice way of thinking about it. I like that.
Yeah.
100 episodes. That means like 300 hours of recorded dialogue.
Pretty close. That's pretty crazy. Plus some bonus episodes.
Right.
Yeah.
What did we accomplish? I'm just kidding. When you...
Ouch.
Well, no, I mean...
I know what you mean, but...
When you reflect on the hundreds of hours of shared, publicly accessible recordings... How do you feel about it? Like, what do you think is its significance for you?
Yeah. Man, that's for all the things that I've been thinking about in the last few weeks, like leading up to talking about this and stuff. Like, what is it, you know, like, what is having that, you know, out in the world, like, mean to me? That's something I haven't really thought about. It's interesting, like it, yeah, for some reason it sort of feels like for me, and I don't know if it feels the same way for you, but for me it sort of feels like in a way I'm saying goodbye to it, but really it's still there. I mean, it's probably not going to get a whole bunch of new listeners or anything like that, but it is like a body of work that's still accessible, and you know, it's not like going away. It's not like it's not going to exist anymore. It's on the internet. I wonder if the Internet Archive, like, archives podcasts, and I wonder, they probably only archive things that get like over a certain number of hits, but.
I think that's probably right. You mean like the Wayback Machine kind of thing?
Yeah, like the Wayback Machine. Yeah, exactly. We're probably not in the Wayback Machine.
The amount of money they must spend on servers to store.
Oh, it's like, crazy. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Restoring the back catalog of every podcast that's ever been made is an expensive proposition.
Yeah, that would be crazy. Yeah, I think, I don't know, like it feels like a pretty, I need to find the right word. Feels weird and not very descriptive to say that you're proud of something or something like that. You know, like it's just, you know, it feels like regardless of what happens with the show, what the next steps are, you know, what I do with, you know, going forward in terms of podcasting or broadcasting or audio production or editing or any of that stuff, it feels like there's like a very real, concrete piece of work that is there that shows that, you know, like we can make something and have it be good and have it be real and have it have some meaning for people. And yeah, I don't know, because of those things, I'm proud of it, I guess I would say.
Cool.
What about you?
What about me?
How does it feel? How does it feel to have like probably, you know, 150 hours of your voice on the internet talking about food and making dumb jokes and
excuse me.
<That's rude>. Sorry, listening to dumb jokes be made and then having to react to them.
The truth is that so much of the like the actual artifact, like the thing that was made and shared, you did that. Like you made it. You did, like, because like the editing and, but like I've never even seen how,
and the posting and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
For me, like what I cherish about it is very selfish and personal, where it's like there's probably a couple dozen almost of the episodes that I feel like are kind of time capsules. Things that like several years ago I would have blogged about for my own, like I've had a blog for 15 years. And it was always like just something, it was like my own record so that I could consult it. And it was fun to share it, especially like if people were into it or could comment on it. But, like it was my own journal, that I could consult. And we have loads of episodes that I am glad exist just so that I can go back and understand what we were doing or what I was up to, like,
or what things you were thinking. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like we go pretty in depth on like the thought process behind a lot of the decision making for a lot of menus that we've both made and stuff like that, right, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the menus is a huge one. There's been loads of events and classes and some of my like travels and like professional development and stages and stuff like that, that we've talked about. The whole CCC process, like, that recording is a really valuable thing for me personally, because like as I say, like get involved with judging for CCC and stuff now, I've gone back and listened to that to just remind myself of what the process is like.
Oh, that's cool.
For the candidates. And so that's like a big chunk of my feeling about it is like I'm grateful to have that record for my own for my own use. There's been lots of, or at least a few examples where something has come up in our conversations and either just because it's interesting or because we decide that we need to like talk about it specifically on an episode, I've been introduced to new ideas, writers, techniques, that have become really important to me. And probably like the example that jumps to mind first is just Jonathan Gold.
Right.
It's like a name I knew and I had seen him. Like, I think I had read a couple things that he had done for Lucky Peach. But him coming up, and then he came up often enough for us that I bought us the book.
Copies of the book.
Copies of Counterintelligence. And that was like, that is now such an important, like, integral part of the way that I think about eating out in Edmonton, and the kinds of places that I go to eat. So there's, a few examples like that where it was just, I never would have, even if I heard that name, like I never would have gotten into it the way that, I did because of the recordings, basically, because we knew we wanted to talk about it. And so we had to engage with it a bit more, and then it became really engrossing. And
I think it's interesting when you're saying that, because like, it's sort of bringing something to mind that I haven't really considered before, but that like, I think plays into, you know, how I feel about having done the show. Mm-hmm. And that's that, like, you know, like, I think to some extent, the format of the show is sort of like a kitchen conversation, you know, like,
right,
you're working, you're in the kitchen,
we're prepping and we're,
you're with your colleagues and you know, like, people are interested in food. People are interested in a lot of things. You talk about a lot of things in the kitchen. It's not just like food talk all the time. But you know, in a lot of cases, people who are working in kitchens are really interested in food. And so you wind up talking about food and cooking and restaurants and complaining about recipes and, you know, like the kinds of things that we talk about on the show. And I think that, like, you know, that's sort of been what the format of the show is to some extent, is sort of like a free form kitchen conversation. Like, we tend to come with a topic, but then it can kind of move all over the place, and
right,
and we kind of don't stop until we're just done talking about it. So, you know, like, and we've, you know, I think for people that know us and have worked with us and who listen to the show, you know, a lot of the comments that I've gotten from several people are like, oh, you know, like, it's like being at work with you guys and like listening to you talking about food in the kitchen or whatever. Mm. And that's true. But because we're recording the show,
less swearing though.
Less swearing. Yeah, totally. Very few swears I've had to cut out of this show, actually. It's astonishing to me. More on my side, I think, like, historically, I've tended to swear a lot when I'm having conversations at work, for good or for ill, I don't know, but I don't do it as much as I used to. In fact, sometimes when people swear in the kitchen now, I'm like, find it a little bit awkward. You know, like, I think because we're coming to the show and like the conversation's maybe like a little bit more formal, there is sort of more of like, you know, it's not just like free form talking. We are kind of like, you know, it's a little bit of call and response and a little bit interview style. Like, we're asking each other questions and then we're responding. And you know, like, I think, and because we're coming with a topic, it like provides a little bit more of like a platform to really explore the ideas that we might just sort of talk about and touch on in a real kitchen conversation. Like, you know, right, you might talk about something for a little while and then might get interrupted by another topic, or it might get interrupted by a timer or something, you know, like it like provides more space and more time to actually explore those topics. And I think that for me is a lot of what's been valuable, is like, you know, having like opinions or something that are like formed in the like fire of kitchen communications, but then actually having to think through those opinions and like find out how I actually feel about them by like exploring them a little bit more in depth and, you know, deciding whether they're ridiculous or whether they have merit. And, you know, that to me, I think, has like been one of the parts of the show is that like has meant a lot to me, is sort of like, I don't know, just getting to get a little bit more in touch with you know, whether my opinions are valid or ridiculous. I think it's, right. you know, that's happened a lot on this show. And yeah,
and
that's
so
been fun.
To me, like, and I agree, like having, first of all, having the semblance of a structure,
we can't even keep a straight face when we say that.
And having it be like something that you know is going to be recorded and shared. Yeah, that did focus me and like push me a little bit to, yeah, try and think through our topics in a way that I wouldn't have usually. But I would say that one thing that is kind of like not frustrating, but like where I always felt like I was falling a little bit short. We would have a topic, like for instance, say the French Laundry cookbook. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that if there was more time and more preparation, like that's yeah. a book that deserves a video essay, basically. Like deserves
yeah.
like a really there's lots that you could say about it, and the prep time for our conversations was always a struggle for me. And it basically, it would happen yeah. like in the 20 minutes before we were going to record. Like I literally for that specific episode was like 20 minutes before we were going to meet, I'm like racing through the book and like writing down page numbers or putting in bookmarks and being like, oh yeah, like there's like
yeah.
this great thing and this great thing and this recipe I've used and that. But it always, for topics like that, I always felt like it deserved more than I was able to give in terms of the prep time.
You yeah, I feel the same way about just yeah. about all of our topics. You know, like I think that, like, I don't know, anyone who's worked in the service industry knows, and especially in restaurants, knows like how precious time is. And especially when you work in this industry, you tend not to have a lot of it, you know? Mm. If you work in this industry and have done it as a career, it, you know, requires, compared, I think, to a lot of careers, it requires a lot of time and attention. I know for me, in my career, for several years of it, I was putting way more time and effort into work than I was into my personal life or my private life. And any time that I had in my personal or private life had to be so streamlined to make sure that I could, like, you know, keep my life, organized and civil and feeling reasonable, not feeling like my personal life was totally out of control and that the only thing I had control over was my work life. Like, there were rare times when I felt like I didn't have enough time for my personal life, but most of the time I was devoting more time to my work life. And, you know, having to claw a little bit of time out for this show from, you know, a life where I know we're both like really busy, it's tricky. And I think that's, you know, part of the reason, you know, like I think looking back at like, you know, what my sort of impression of what the show was going to be like when we started was that there would be more time for homework and research and coming up with topics and, I don't know, sitting down for meals together so that we could talk about them, or, you know, mm-hmm. writing menus mm-hmm. together or things like that. And it's just like, you know, it's tricky. You have two kids, you have a job that requires a lot of your time. My focus is, you know, a lot of my work as well. And it's tricky to carve out that time. Mm-hmm. I think, like, given the circumstances, I feel really great about the content of the show. But I also right. know that there's like a world in which, like, if we had endless time and endless resources, this show could be something more like, I don't know, 99% Invisible or something, like,
right.
but yeah. cooking related or something mm-hmm. like that. That's, you know, like, that's a podcast whose quality and content I definitely aspire to. It's right. like, you know, and I, you know, like, I didn't think when we started this show that it was going to be 99% Invisible for food. I, you know, understood what the format was going to be to some extent, but, you know, like, there's like a gradient between those two things. And, you know, if I had my choice and we had all the time in the world, I'd love to be like further along the gradient to something that's like more well-researched and more well-produced and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And there's definitely like a crazy scale. Like if you take, like I was talking about the time capsule pieces where it's like, well, I had to like write that menu and cook that menu for my job. And now if you want to come and eat it, like we can just talk about it. And like, it's no, there's no extra work because you just like, you have to put in the time to come and eat it. But after that,
but it's those like, were why those we were excellent topics for the show. It's like work that we had to do anyways, basically. And then we were allowed, and then we were, you know, sort of, allowed by the existence of the podcast to come in and have a conversation about it. And there was no real like extra outside work required, you know. It's like a pre-built topic, and that's why I think we relied on those types of topics quite a bit.
Right. And the other end of the spectrum is, I can't remember when or what the title was, but like you had tasked me with writing a Tim Burton themed menu or Tim Burton inspired menu, and I was like, that's a really fun, awesome idea. I don't have time for that, Jesus. Like, and so I put a pumpkin on the menu or something, but if I had a more time to reflect and cook through it and everything,
I guess with that assignment, I just probably thought it would be easy for me because my brain's just full of Tim Burton menus all the time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's a good idea for a pop-up.
It is a really good idea for a pop-up, especially because I guess now Tim Burton's going to blow up again or something.
Why?
I don't know, because Beetlejuice came out again and people were like, oh, this is funny.
And did he direct the new one?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was pretty funny.
Was Michael Keaton in it?
Michael Keaton is in it, yeah. Okay. And Winona Ryder. Okay. And what's her name? Catherine O'Hara, who is amazing in it. She's really great in it. She's one of the best parts of it, actually. She's so great.
I think we would be remiss. Like, I don't know how to bring this up in a natural way, but it would be a shame if this whole last 100th episode recording went through and we didn't just talk about the fact, like, how many episodes that we did just about movies and TV. Like, it's at least 10. Right?
At least
10 episodes about movies and TV. Yeah.
Yeah. And those are like, to some extent, those topics feel like a little bit of a cop out, if I'm going to be like perfectly honest.
Yeah.
You know? But for me, they're also some of the most fun. Like, I don't know how it is for a listener listening to those episodes. But for me, it's like a real like intersection of like my interests. Like I'm really into pop culture and I'm really into food. And so talking about food movies for me is just like, man, that's gold.
Yeah.
I love that. That's a great conversation.
Yeah.
Sorry if the listeners didn't love hearing about Ratatouille all the time, but man, love that movie.
Yeah. It's a tricky one. Like, I think one of the difficulties for that specifically is, besides Ratatouille, most of those movies are kind of niche. Like they're
That's true.
And so I love watching kind of like video essays on YouTube about movies and TV shows that I've already watched. Like, it's almost as fun for me to watch those as just rewatching the show. And I do it often. Like and so it's challenging though, like if you have a movie like what was the Japanese horror one that we just talked about?
Chime?
Yeah, like you have a movie that where no one's seen that movie. Not a
nobody's seen that movie. It's impossible to even get a copy of it. Yeah. I don't know how I got a copy of it.
And so I wouldn't be like willing to watch a review, like a detailed discussion and review of a movie that I haven't seen, especially
that you'd never seen and that was totally obscure.
But
you're right about that.
It was
that.
Fun to have the conversation.
Who knows, Alan? Maybe somebody will watch Chime because we talked about it. Maybe.
Maybe.
If anyone needs a copy, hit me up. I'll try and figure it out. But I'm pretty sure I said that on the episode, and definitely nobody hit me up. So,
Why aren't you guys hitting up Shale more? Come on.
Yeah, come on. Shale's got a back catalog of obscure nonsense food movies that everyone needs to see. I really wish that when we had started making this show, I had like written down a list of objectives or something like that. Mm-hmm. To like be able to go back now and be like, what did we, you know, like what of the objectives that I had in mind, like what did we accomplish? I tried to think about it a little bit. I tried to like put myself in the headspace of where I think I was when we were first starting the show. Mm-hmm. So I tried to retrospectively write down some objectives. I got a few of them here. I'll just read through them and then maybe we can talk about like whether we thought we were successful or not.
Okay.
So I think like number Wait, can one I
guess,
for
can
me.
Can I guess what number one was? Be sure. Super famous and super wealthy from the podcast. Is that the first one?
Yeah, that was the first one. Oh, do okay. you think we got No.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Number one was get to work on my hobby. I had like thought about starting a podcast for a really long time. I knew that I had some of the skills that were required to do that. And so I didn't feel like it was unachievable for me to start one and work on it and put it out. Mm-hmm. That one is an easy win, I guess. Mm-hmm. Get to involve my friends in doing that. I think that I definitely accomplished. We definitely
friends
accomplished.
Plural?
Yeah. I think, you know, you're my friend and you were probably the most involved, or definitely were the most involved. But, you know, we both have a lot of friends who listen to the show and talk to us right. about the show. And
yes. Yeah. That's true. That's a check. That's a check mark.
That's a check mark. Get to build a community of people who love food and cooking. And this one's really hard to quantify. I know that we have a lot of people who have listened to every episode of this show. I think when I had it in my head, though, it was more like there was going to be, you know, interaction online and talking about the show and putting up recipes and talking to people about what they cook. And there is definitely near the beginning some of that. And we got some great like feedback from some of the listeners. Judy, for one, wrote in and we talked a lot about stuff that Judy wanted to reach out to us about stuff on the show and mm-hmm. and others as well. It was like here and there, there were definitely like bits and pieces of gold in terms of interacting with listeners of the show. But mm-hmm. I think my vision was more like, you know, we would have an online community sort of, you know, like, I don't know, like
right.
a Discord or something where we would talk about the show and people would suggest topics and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think like, that's just tricky. You need sort of a critical mass, I think, in terms of numbers of listeners. And I don't think we ever got to that point with this show. And so I don't know. That one's kind of a 50-50. I'm right. not sure.
That's been one of the big, like, I know what you mean in terms of the objective. And I will say that I am uniquely bad at that kind of, like, the promotion required for that and the like having a like online presence that people like, because we had like sometimes people would send messages or comments and stuff like that. And I just like go days without looking at social media sometimes. And I think that didn't help.
I don't know what helped and what didn't, but I am also not that great at that. I think like, I don't know, maybe this is something that we should give some thought to while we're considering, what we, want to do in terms of resurrecting this show is like finding, you know, like finding a way to like have outreach to bring in new listeners. I think, you know, like if we can involve someone with the show who's really good at that or something, because I've never been good at that either. I've been pretty good at like making sure that I'm checking our social media and responding when people message us and things like that. Because I get really excited when we get feedback from listeners and stuff like, you know, but at like generating it, I'm not very good, you know, and being active with it after the fact, I'm also not that great. So
I will also, we've mentioned this before, but I will also say that Instagram like changed so dramatically shortly after we started the show, that and that was kind of like how we were trying to get the show out to people, and like, and that was like more than the actual recordings, like Instagram was set up for us to like be the forum where people could comment on the show, but like Instagram started sucking in a big way shortly after we started the show.
Yeah.
It changed dramatically. We've talked about it. Like it's
sure did. Like it changed to try to be a lot more like TikTok. I wasn't really into like putting videos up. You really have to like chase to get any kind of reach with your posts on Instagram now. And yeah,
but just the organic, like even people that you know in real life, like just didn't have,
yeah,
they
exactly.
seemed like they were cut off from each other.
Really made it, tried to make it more algorithmic, tried to keep people engaged by showing them content that they would think that they would like instead of showing them content from people that they knew. Right. And yeah, I'm sure that didn't help. But, you know, regardless, like if either of us had been really good at social media promotion, I'm sure we would have found the right forum or the right venue for promoting the show, and just that's not really a strength of either of ours. So I guess that's where we wound up. We need advice. If a listener has some social media advice for us, I'm all ears. And then I think like when we started, part of the idea that I had in mind was at least to have the costs of the show covered somehow eventually. Like I think before we ever started the show, like a year before we started the show, but when I like was kicking around the idea and like kind of talking to you about it, Alan, I think I made a joke one day that maybe like 5 years in, we would earn enough money from the show to like go and have a meal in New York. Mm-hmm. And now that seems like a silly objective. I think like, you know, we never got to that point. And so the show became, we want to get to talk to each other and get to talk to the listeners of the show. And that was that became like the motivating factor for continuing to make the show. Over time though, because the show, like I think, you know, the original vision was eventually to have the costs covered. I, you know, like the format of the show when we first envisioned it was kind of like heavy on time, like time that to record the show and time to edit the show and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that has sort of like not borne out to be entirely sustainable. It's like gotten kind of tough to find the time to get together and have the conversation and do the editing. Even though we only put out a show every 2 weeks, it has gotten like, it has become a little bit of a struggle to find that time. So I think, you know, we need to just take a step back and reevaluate and figure out a way to do this show where we can, you know, make it fit into our life, you know, a little more sustainably.
Right. Yeah.
So like D minus on that last one, I guess. We never got to go to New York and have a meal. Maybe we should just do that anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, if you find $1,000 bill on the sidewalk or something, Alan.
You know they don't make those anymore? Did you know that?
That's for now. Soon, like a dollar is going to be $1,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What do you think? What are your favorite moments? Do you have a list of favorite moments of the show? This is such a hard thing. I was like looking back through our list of episodes. I went through like our entire list of the episodes and read all of the like short like blurbs about the content of the episodes. And man, it's so hard to like pick through and remember the, you know, remember the funny things that I thought were hilarious or, you know, there's just like, there's so much. There's so much.
So I mentioned my time capsules. Like there's several of those that I remember very fondly from mostly the menus that you were able to come and taste that we talked about at Ernest's. And like my stint at Naramata Inn and at Cook's Camp in Pemberton and the CCC episode that I've already mentioned. I really like the Team Canada 92. I don't know if you remember, there was like,
yeah, I remember
a menu I had to make that was supposed to recreate a menu from Culinary Team Canada's gold medal at the ICA Culinary Olympics in 1992.
Yeah, that was crazy. We had all the costing materials for it and everything.
Yeah. And the owl, the chocolate owl rant.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't like that, but I remember it because it was
so dumb.
And I think you played a clip of Crisscross or something. I don't know. There was some 1992 kind of nostalgia pieces there.
Totally. I remember that clip of Crisscross.
Yeah. That's like one category of show that I really enjoyed. One of the actually just like most fun conversations to have. I don't know how it how people listen to it feel, but like the Halloween candy one.
Yeah,
it was just like I think it was over under, like overrated, underrated for Halloween candy.
Yeah,
that was just like fun because I didn't have to do any prep, but felt very strongly about everything that came up.
Those are some of my faves too, where it's like something that's easy to have a dumb opinion about, something that's like so subjective, but that you're allowed to have an opinion about and you just get to like talk about it. Those are some fun episodes. There's just lots of room for like making fun of each other and making dumb jokes.
Right.
Yeah.
The kind of almost like, I don't know what, like Seinfeld-esque, like minutia, where you can get into like, there was some part of that conversation that was like Cherry Blasters and Fuzzy Peach and Sour Patch Kids. Like they're all the same thing. They're just like at slightly different places on this flavor spectrum.
Yeah.
Anyways, I just,
for having an opinion about candy corn. Like that's just such a ridiculous thing to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's probably like front of mind for right now because my kids are still working on their Halloween. Like we're almost a month out from, past Halloween, but they still have candy that they're working on. And yeah.
that's some good investment in the candy bank. It's paying off
usually
long term.
Usually they kind of like start to forget, like once they've eaten all their very favorite things, they start to forget that the candy bag exists, and then we just like make it disappear. But it's going long this year.
Huh. It's just candy corns in there now though, hey?
No, there's some, I was looking at Oliver's and he has a full size Snickers, a full size.
Wow, really?
And a full size Big Turk.
Dang.
But it's usually because like the full size ones last longer because we don't let them eat. Like when they're like, can I have a treat for my candy bag? It's like, sure, but not a full size one.
Right. So when do they get to eat the full size one? Christmas Day.
Yeah, I guess. They just disappear after they go to bed somehow.
Right. Who's handing out Big Turks in your neighborhood? I'm coming over there next year.
I don't know. I don't even know if the kids like Big Turk, but yeah, they have a full-size Big Turk. But
that's perfect. You can just cut a little wedge off, and if they don't like it, then you've got yourself a Big Turk.
Right.
I mean, they're kind of bad, but they're kind of good in a bad way.
It's a good concept. It's good. It's a good idea.
It's a good idea. It's kind of always how I felt about it.
Yeah. There's two... Okay, some notable episode or episode formats that I wanted to point out, because it, maybe in a way, okay, they were great recordings and I enjoyed making them. And in a way, they are a representation of that problem of like us not having the time to prep more or like to do the back end work. One is the when we had Millie on, and was, I think the episode is called Listener Millie. But like, and just because she kind of grew up in a family restaurant and we got to hear her story. That to me is
that
like,
was great.
And could be like a format for something that I think would be really interesting and engaging, especially if like for people in Edmonton.
Totally. I think that episode, like for me, was like, you know, among some others, but like that for me was like the encapsulation of what I think for me the show aspired to be. Right. You know, like it's just like very difficult and tricky to like do the scheduling and the prep and find the right guests. And it, like, I think, you know, we both, I think, wanted to be able to have guests on the show more often. And especially once we did that episode, I think we both were like, yeah, like this is great, you know, to have somebody else's perspective and for us to be able to learn things like genuinely on the show from somebody else's experience and give the listeners that opportunity. Like that to me is like, yeah, what the show aspired to. It's just like never was going to be sustainable for us to actually do the work that was needed to schedule people. Like even if we tried to do it once every few months or something, we did try with a few other guests. It's just like really tricky to schedule, especially when the both of us are already so limited schedule wise.
The other ones that I remember because they were fun, but also because they could be, if there were more time to do the research, could be a long-term format, like an interesting, compelling long-term format, was the amateur menu historian corner episodes.
Yeah, for sure.
And though we had one about the Siege of Paris 1870 menu that basically the proteins all came from the Paris Zoo. And then we had the one that was
so crazy.
The futurist cookbook, the futurist menu, like by the fascist Italian Marinetti, that was supposed to be like a refutation of all classical or comfort foods, and it was supposed to like be the modernist in the most extreme way.
What was the deal with the stainless steel chicken or whatever? I can't even remember.
Yeah, it was like chicken infused with steel, like shot through with steel so that you can taste steel. Really dumb. But those were so fun and so weird and so interesting to me. But really, like, we were only able to talk about them because I had done the research for those kind of on my own time over the last few years, kind of, do you know what I mean? And so like to do something like that every 2 weeks, it would be like a job.
Yeah.
Like a
there's just not enough time to do any of that research. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Those were great though. Those episodes were like, a little further up that spectrum towards something like 99% Invisible or something, you know, like where you're right. talking about, like the history of something and, you know, how, it, you know, and what the impressions are of it and, you know, like in modern day and I don't know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Little extra editing, a little extra research.
Yeah.
Not that far off.
The ones, so like I mentioned those, the time capsule episodes, but the, in our higher level discussion, I was talking about ones that like pushed me into new, like things that I wouldn't have looked into at all if I didn't know that we were going to talk about it or because we talked about it. The AI one, getting AI to write menus. I never would have engaged with ChatGPT if it weren't for that episode. And I've since used it lots, and it's just fascinating to me. Like
another like cross section of Shale's interests, like shameless, like I'm just gonna bring my own in my own things that I'm interested in to the show, you know, like regardless of whether they may be interesting to anyone else or not.
Right. I think also the TikTok one, this is silly and it makes me sound really lame, but like the TikTok episodes that we did, mm-hmm. I think have helped me understand some of the stuff that my students bring to class, some of the ideas that my students bring to class.
Almost certainly,
it really is how that generation gets a lot of their food information.
Yeah.
Or their food, I don't know what. And just being able to recognize those ideas when they're brought into the classroom and be able to either like coax them in the right direction so that it's appropriate for what we're trying to teach and serve at NAIT, or just to like see through it and just be able to kibosh it and say, did you get that idea from TikTok? Has been really useful for me.
I think it's also interesting, like, I don't know if you have opportunity to do this, but like it happens to me in my job fairly often where I do see like suggestions for things that are clearly from social media.
Right.
And then like, but you know, like for most things that I see on social, like there's definitely some novel stuff, and I learn things from TikTok cooking videos all the time, but like usually, you know, the people who are getting those ideas from TikTok aren't really aware of the history of where those ideas may have come from. And if you have a lot more context, you can kind of like, you know, provide some context for why that's now a thing that's blowing up or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting too.
Absolutely. Oh, we maybe have talked about this. Like I had a student who they saw a TikTok video for 1,000-layer potatoes. And they were like, can we make this?
And I was like, we make that all the time. It's called something different.
It's a pavé or it's dauphinoise or whatever. But like,
I actually had that exact same conversation with someone like a week and a half ago, Alan.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's just funny because it's like, well, yeah, like there's a recipe for it in your textbook. Like it was in your backpack this whole time, but it took a TikTok video for you to think that it was cool.
Yeah. Soon the textbook that you hand out at the beginning of your course, Alan, will be a playlist of TikTok videos. So then
soon enough. Yep. You're right.
Soon enough. Any day now. Mm-hmm. It'll be like a link to download ChatGPT, like the ChatGPT app, and then just a playlist of TikTok videos that show all of the traditional dishes, like 1,000-layer potatoes.
Milfoy, right? Isn't that what that means? 1,000 yes. 1,000 leaves, I guess, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. 1,000 leaves.
Same thing.
Who knew? They invented it way back then? I can't believe it. Yeah, I think like this is a little bit bittersweet, because for me, some of the highlights, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's because the pressure was off a little bit, but like some of the highlights for me are some of the bonus content, like us talking about Jonathan Gold and talking about restaurant reviews from Jonathan Gold, or talking about the Best of Bridge. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There was some really funny conversations, and also we get to read a Jonathan Gold review. Like it's kind of too bad that not a lot of people have wound up hearing that stuff. I think, like, I don't know when this is going to happen, but I'm probably just going to release that bonus content. Like maybe like either I'll release like the Jonathan Gold ones, like weekly or something, starting at some point, and just release them all weekly and just release one a week until they're all released. And then maybe the Best of Bridge as well, just to keep something in the feed for a while until we come back, because they're already edited. I would just have to post them in the feed. So that's nice and easy. Great. And it gives people something to listen to. They're like really short. They're like, I don't know. I think the longest one is like 20 minutes or something like that, but mm-hmm. And they also don't have a cold open, and they also don't have much of a theme song. There's like one like little hit from like one little note from the theme song as a lead in or whatever. But yeah, I think I might just release them just for fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was great. Making the bonus content. Those are like fun things. It was really good because the pressure's off a little bit. We don't have to really think about what we're going to talk about. We do have to read a review before we come in, or I have to find a recipe in the Best of Bridge or whatever. But we have like a preset, don't need to like give it much consideration thing to talk about. And then, you know, it always leads to a little bit of like deeper conversation about food or whatever. It's, you know, it's not strictly about what the topic is about, but it just gives us an in to talk about the things that we find interesting about the restaurant or the writing or the recipe or whatever.
Right.
I really enjoyed that, like doing short little bits.
And I liked trying to like reading the gold reviews, but then trying to compare and contrast them to the Edmonton scene was really interesting. Like, especially for, like the Bun Mi one, like it started with a gold review, but then it just became a conversation about our
Bun Mi in Edmonton,
Vietnamese subs. And I think that it was a fun conversation to have, and probably was, or hopefully interesting to people who live in Edmonton and have eaten at some of those places. So,
yeah. I think too, like another sort of, I don't know, this isn't really a highlight because it doesn't really pertain to any one single episode. Although there is one episode called Do Recipes Work, where it was like kind of a deep exploration of my conjecture that recipes don't really work or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, they're like, it's sort of been a bit of a recurring topic on the show because it is sort of this like weird opinion that I have that I've been trying to explore. And the show really gave me like a platform to do that exploration. And yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because like I have, like before we ever talked about it on the show, it was just sort of like this reactionary opinion that I had. Was it just like, oh yeah, recipes are over there, but you know, I just need them for a little bit of inspiration or whatever. And I don't actually need them for cooking, and I don't actually need them for writing my own recipes really, you know, but I don't know. It's like, I feel like I don't necessarily feel the opposite now, but I feel way differently than I did, you know, before we ever talked about it on the show. And I also think it's really interesting that we got to sort of like have these conversations on the show. I think like this is an interesting, like the time that we've been doing the show, like the last 4 years, and obviously it extends a little bit farther back than that, and it will extend farther into the future. But like really how people approach learning how to cook is like very different than it was 5 years ago. Like watching them, like there were cooking shows a long time ago, you know, and before that there were influential cookbooks like we talked about at the beginning of the show. You know, there's always been sort of like a platform to get the information from, but like being able to like watch somebody do it in real time, like on YouTube or something like that, really is just, I don't know, it's like a level up in terms of being able to contextualize what you need to do and what things need to look like. And you know, it's not the same as doing it hands on beside someone. You can't smell things. You can't feel how hot the stove is and stuff like that. But like being able to watch somebody in real time cook something on YouTube is like, I don't know. Even if the YouTube videos aren't like professionally produced or anything, it's just like, it's such an important added layer to being able to like internalize what you need to do to cook something.
Right.
Just makes it so much more possible to like for instance, like for me to cook Japanese food or Chinese food, or, you know, these other like rabbit holes that I'm really interested in, have gone down deep rabbit holes with, like, you know, it's one thing to pick up a book, but like watching a Japanese person make like teriyaki chicken from start to finish is a completely different experience than like reading about it in a cookbook, you know? Yes. Like, it's just, it's so much better. It's so, there's, the information is so much denser and so much richer. It's, I don't know, like, I feel like we're sort of at the beginning of a revolution in terms of people being able to cook like really good food from other places, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you want to start a YouTube channel?
No way, man. Oh. I've thought about it like several times, especially like when Kenji was kind of like, when his channel was like first blowing up and all he was doing was putting like a camera on top of his head.
Right.
Like POV cooking or whatever. Yep. I was like, maybe I could do that. But man, it's so much work to edit a YouTube video and upload it, even what Kenji's doing. Like, and he's doing that all on his own and editing everything on his own and stuff. And now he's like branching out and like, you know, doing different styles of videos and things like that. But yeah, even that is like so much work. I just don't have time, unfortunately. I got other cooking things that I want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe if I get like really into cooking something specific, maybe I'll get a little camera that I can mount on my head and just save all the footage in case someday I'm like, oh man, I have all this great footage and I have like 6 months and I have nothing to do. Then
maybe. By then AI can edit it for you probably.
I mean, yeah. You're probably not wrong. I actually should start saving. Actually, I think I'm just going to get like a head mounted camera and start wearing it everywhere now. Another thing, like, in reference to what you were saying about like, you know, having the show be a document or a bit of a time capsule. I also want to retroactively go back and generate transcripts for all of the shows and have them be searchable, like publicly, just so that, you know, even just for us, so that if we want to search, like if we know that we talked about something sometime and we forgot what we said, or we think that there's information there that we need for something that we're working on now or something like that, that it would be easy for us to go back and search through and find the spot in the episode and go listen to it or whatever.
Right. Yep.
It's becoming increasingly not a big deal to do that. And so I do intend to do that. It's probably not going to be like next week or anything, but I will do that and make it public. And I'm sure that it's, you know, like in the timeline of what we're doing with the show and when we might restart the show in a different format, I'm pretty sure it's before then. So
cool.
And we'll definitely like put a little announcement note or something on the Instagram feed when we do that, if people want to go and search for their favorite moments of the show, search for when we talked about the dumbest thing that they can imagine and they were like, I can't believe they're talking about this right now.
What did they say about Manuka honey again? Shoot, I can't.
Yeah, exactly. I'm at the grocery store and I have to buy Manuka honey. What did they say again? Yeah.
I'm really nervous about the ending of this episode. Like,
me too.
Because like, it's got to be great, right? Like, it's got
to
be a hilarious.
It's got to be the greatest ending to any episode we've made ever.
Yeah.
Hey, listeners. You can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.